Welcome back. As we continue on this Tuesday night, it's a real privilege to have a gentleman on this hour whom I have respected for decades. When I first began to do my research, and it was very thorough for an individual at the university level, into what really happened in World War II, and certainly all about the Holocaust. One of the top people in the world, one of the bravest people, the most courageous people, was Guillermo Rudolph, who stood very firm on his research into the subject, which is a very complicated story, by the way. It's not some little cut-and-dried thing you can just throw around. Ultimately, he was arrested for his problems that he was causing with the status quo and so forth. It's quite a story. We're not here to talk about that tonight, but we are here to talk about what he has produced, and it is a remarkable book. It is called The Holocaust Encyclopedia, Uncensored and Unconstrained. It's really an extraordinary look at the evidence, all the pertinent evidence that upholds the orthodox Holocaust narrative. It's an examination, the true, the false, and the mendacious. You'll find the whole story in this book, and you can pick it up and open it anywhere and start learning. It's meticulously researched. Guillermo has spent a lot of time on it, many years in theory. There's a video on the page. If you click on the link right below his name, you can go to that page. It's holocaustencyclopedia.com. Very simple. But there's a video there. I'm going to play just a minute of it right now, give you an idea, and then we'll say hello to Guillermo. Here it is.
An introduction. After more than 30 years of intense archival and forensic research, critical Holocaust scholars have amassed a veritable deluge of publications. It is so voluminous, in fact, that no one can wrap their head around it anymore without proper guidance. But no such guidance has existed so far. Hence, the project to create such a guidance in the shape of an encyclopedia was born in early 2022. As with any such reference work, the idea is to allow both the novice and the expert to quickly find all the pertinent information and references to further reading about any relevant keyword that may come to mind. And here it is. The following will give a brief overview of this reference work, how it is structured, and what you can expect to find in it. We start out by looking up the one entry in this book that lies at the center, the one on the Holocaust. For anyone trying to get a general understanding of this topic, that's the best place to start. It starts out by giving a few examples of the use of this term in connection with the persecution of Jews that appeared in newspapers prior to the Second World War, in fact, even before the First World War. There are many more examples like this, but I need to be brief here. The first mass media use of this term in connection with what we today call the Holocaust occurred in 1942. The term Holocaust became generally accepted as referring to the fate of the Jews during World War II.
Okay, we'll stop there. The entire video is about 20, 29 minutes, something like that. But you can see it at holocaustencyclopedia.com. Take a listen. And if it's for you, this is a real important historical achievement. And we get to look at history as it really happened. Guillermo, welcome to the program. And I want to say it's really an honor to have you on. You're one of the historical legends in this whole field of trying to uncover the truth about what really happened in this whole story. Good to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
Yes, before we get into it, I want to perhaps say that I have been involved in creating this encyclopedia, but I am standing on the shoulders of giants. Right now, I'm in the process of turning one of the revisionist classics into an audiobook, and that is Arthur Budd's Hoax of the 20th Century, which appeared in 1976 in its first edition. So we're almost at the 50-year mark of the first appearance of that book. It's just 2 years away.
Arthur Butts, B-U-T-Z, for you listening. Arthur Butts, yeah.
That's right. 2003, I had the honor of releasing an updated new edition of that for the first time. And ever since, we have been issuing new editions, and this one is one in the preparation that's coming out.
Yes.
Updated again, and also it will have an audio edition so that people can actually listen to the book. And as I am going through this book, it strikes me over and over again what a visionary Arthur Butz was in 1976 with the little information that he had access to try to figure out what really happened to the Jews in the Second World War and how this myth of what we call today the Holocaust, the mainstream Holocaust narrative, was formed and what the background was. And I'm going through this just after I had released the Holocaust Encyclopedia. So I have created this work for which I had to assemble encyclopedic knowledge. Now, you can publish an encyclopedia only and write it, basically, if you have this encyclopedic overlook of a topic, which I've gathered over the past 30 years of being involved in publishing material. And it strikes me over and over again how much Arthur Butz was able to figure out, at least in the rough and in the general shape of what had happened, without really knowing too much about it. But he had to guess, he had to assume, and so forth. But he got it right over and over and over again. And I'm just amazed how well he figured it out back then. Now, our knowledge has deepened tremendously, has broadened tremendously, but the general outline was there right at the beginning with Arthur Butz's book from 1976. And that's what humbling me. It's a humbling experience to see, my God, this guy had nobody to build his work on. He had to do it all from scratch, and he figured out so much already.
Right.
It
wasn't copying other people's work. He was actually doing the serious journalistic deep dive research. The hoax of the 20th century, Arthur Butz. I remember the book well when I was in college, and I read most of it. I don't think I quite completed it, but I had it, and it was one of the cornerstones of my awakening, so to speak, to this whole issue of the Holocaust. Now, it's a cut-and-dried little scenario. You either accept it and stand with it and fight for it, or you're a traitor. But that's not how history really is. History is very complicated, and to assemble history correctly is a monumental achievement, especially now when so much of it has been erased and corrupted. So good that you mentioned that. Arthur Butz, thank you for that, indeed.
Yeah. That is integrated in the Holocaust Handbook series that I launched around the turn of the millennium, and that was integrated in 2003 as Volume 7. It's still in it. We're up to volume 52 now of that series, most of them very deep-diving archival and forensic research studies on subsections of this huge topic. You know, it's easy to say the Holocaust, but what it is a massive complex of events that spans over 4 or 5 years, an entire continent, and encompasses so many events and locations. And to just put one umbrella term on it, and that's it. It's not so easy. I have started working on this topic in 1991, and the very first major work I published together with a lot of other authors later appeared in an English edition was Dissecting the Holocaust, which is number one of the series. And back then I thought, well, I have pretty much encompassed the whole topic by having 15 authors working to me, everyone addressing a different topic, and we put it all together in an anthology and published that in Germany in 1994 for the first time.
15 authors. See, that's not, Germar, excuse me, but that's not done now. The level and the depth of your research and the breadth of it, with 15 authors working and digging and trying to find out the truth, which had already by the 90s been pretty well corrupted in many circles. Go ahead. That's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was I got personally involved as a chemist. I was working on my PhD, and I had a personal interest, wrote a letter off to the editor and said, well, there's so much research from a chemical point of view to be done about those chemical reactions and the toxicology involved with Cyclone B, the buzzword that everyone is in everyone's mind when it comes to oceans. And then I was asked by defense lawyers to get to prepare an expert report on this question, which I did, and got me in a lot of trouble. But at the same time, I realized this is such a small subtopic of a small aspect of a camp, which in itself is only a small subtopic of this broader issue of all the camps. And again, all the camps of the Third Reich is a small subtopic of everything that is said to have happened to the Jews, but also other minorities are included in that on occasion. But I realize it's just way too much. I can't just pick at some stones, scrape off some samples and make an analysis and can then come to the result that I figured it all out. No, that's not how it works. It was just the horizon of the issues involved was widening and widening and overwhelming me. So I was looking for support. I was looking for other people. I gathered everyone around who was willing to cooperate on the project to get all the knowledge we have right now together to update it and get it out in this anthology. That's what I did. And I thought it's over for me because I'm not a historian. I'm not in this position of having access to all this knowledge, of having the skills to do it. But life put me in the position over the next 30 years. It was 1994 when it came out. Now it's 2024, 30 years later, of doing exactly that. That was not the end of my journey of discovery, working together with other scholars in the field. I didn't know. I thought it's the end. I thought, that's as much as I can do, and now I stop. No, it was the beginning of the journey. It was the volume one of that series. We're up to volume 52 now in English, in German. And we started putting stuff out in Spanish. And for 30 years, it's become my life, and more just professional life, unfortunately. When the government throws the book at you, trying to stop you from doing this forensic research, this archival research.
Well, as all of you can realize, there's a certain group out there that does not like this kind of a research effort focusing on such a big cash cow as, frankly, I'm speaking for myself, not Guillermar, that the Holocaust has become. Israel
it's
international
not
Zionism.
A certain group.
Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't have. I always tell people, you know, by the way, it's covered in the encyclopedia. There's an entire entry on motives. Who is involved in creating and propagating their own narrative for what motive? Because there are many narratives out there. Of course, we all hear the big one, the mainstream one, through medias and so forth. But there are other narratives. There are extreme narratives on the Zionist Jewish side that go overboard on one edge. Then there are others. So motive is a real issue, but it's not just the Zionists, Israel, or whatever you want to call it, or the Jews, which is an umbrella term that doesn't even apply necessarily because they are Jewish revisionists too. A lot of groups have their dog in the fight, so to say, and it's not just Zionist, Israeli, Jewish interests. That is the problem, of course, because in my case, I was a German citizen trying to live and make a living and starting a career in Germany, and then the German government and the German society at large goes after you like the devil goes after the poor soul, and burned the bridges behind me, one bridge after another, and I had no way of returning. It was surrender and face the ruin of your career and with nothing left, or dig in and try to make the best of it. And I turned it into my career. I turned it into my passion, into my calling, and into the only path forward left to me after the persecutorial system burned the bridges behind me and threatened me.
Yeah, I admire your verbal restraint here, because what was done, I followed this story of what was happening to you back then. I was watching it that closely. And Guillermar is understating this. He really demonstrated the highest degree of courage in fighting through this. I'll just leave it at that. Go ahead, please.
Well, in school we had to read Kafka's The Trial. I don't know whether you ever read the book.
Not that one, no.
It's basically a story. It's fiction, of course. It tells a story that a guy is put on trial, and it's not really told what he's on trial for. It is the term Kafkaesque on a legal level, that you're being dragged through proceedings without being told what it's all about, without being able to defend yourself. It's absurd and grotesque to the extreme, but it is all set in a completely quote-unquote normal setting that makes it completely surreal. And unfortunately, this is in a way I have experienced it in Germany, being dragged through courts as a witness already while I was called into the witness stand by defense lawyers as an expert on questions of Zyklon B toxicology, analytics, and so forth. It started with judges threatening me as a witness. If I testify to the best of my knowledge, they are going to have me arrested. This is bizarre, but that is actually what happened in German courts when I was not even in the witness stand yet, but the defense lawyers wanted to get me there. I was still sitting there waiting to be put in the witness stand, and already the judge threatening me. And later I was put on trial for my research, and they would deny me any way of defending myself, turn every motion down, and would muzzle my lawyers, prevent them from saying a word in court. It becomes so bizarre when you realize the legal framework has been rigged to the point where you completely, where the system, the courts can completely turn any defense impossible. So in German rule of law and the German code, the defense is not allowed to introduce any evidence. That's how it starts.
Profile now is being acted out here in our courts, in our legal system, in our judges. For maybe not that bad, but I think it's going in that direction, unquestionably.
I don't know. Every country, I have unfortunately legal experience in a few countries. Now every country has a legal system that has weaknesses, and I've felt the ones in Germany. Be that as it may, I don't want to go into too much detail because we want to focus on something else, and that is what came out at the end of it with all the persecution, with all the strife. I found myself in a personal situation a little over a year ago where I faced on a personal front the collapse of my family, of my marriage. Don't want to go into the detail there, but sometimes this opens up the opportunity when you're suddenly alone, your family's gone, your home's gone, and you're all by yourself. You're 24/7 and to yourself and nothing left, then there is the need to find a calling, to find a purpose, to do something that makes sense when everything else has collapsed. And I was asked by a person who was looking for orientation on this Holocaust issue, who was trying to run a discussion group. He was actually running a discussion group, and he wanted to wrap his head around all the information that's out there. So he ordered the Holocaust Handbook series, all books that were out more than a year ago. Uh-huh. I think we were up to 48 or so, and he ordered the whole thing. And it was way too much information. I said, to read all these books, it takes you years to get through them. And by the time you get to the end, you have forgot the beginning again, and you start over. And if you want to look for something, you have a question. Where do I find information on that topic? There's no comprehensive index for the whole series. So where would I find it? It's just impossible. I know it to some degree where to look for something because I've published it all once in one edition, second edition, third edition, English translation, German translation, and I'm going to, so I have been over it over and over and over again, so I know it, but anyone else out there wouldn't. So he said, well, now I have all this series, all these massive amount of research books, and no way of of accessing this information. We need an encyclopedia. And I had already had the idea of creating one back in 2001. Some Jewish or Israeli watchdog organization, I can't remember anymore exactly what it was, issued one of the usual annual reports on worldwide anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And they subsume Holocaust revisionism in that category. So if you don't believe every aspect of the mainstream narratives regarding the Holocaust, then you are automatically an anti-Semite, because whatever motivation could you possibly have than not disliking the Jews, what else could drive you to deny the obvious? And that's absolutely not the case, but that's the way they look at it. And so that's subsumed in this area, and they had a statement in there, something that, to the effect that the only outlet in the world that still produces new and relevant material, they call it Holocaust denial material, is Kasler Publishers. That was the name of my publishing company that I established in the 1990s and had been running for or working for the most part, and where all this material was published. And that was quite a pleasant assessment of the situation. It's not good to be the only one who does new and relevant material, but it is nice to be given that predicate of new and relevant. And then they said something to the fact that Gemma Rudolf published an encyclopedia of the Holocaust denial.
Of course, that's how they would present it.
No.
Everything is twisted. Everything is reversed.
Yeah. So that was in the summer of 2021, at which point I had not published the Holocaust encyclopedia. And I was a little bit pissed, because it's typical for them to mislabel stuff. What I had published at that point was, of course, the Holocaust handbook series, with a lot of individual studies focusing on certain aspects and subtopics of the overall topic. But it's not an encyclopedia by any stretch of the imagination. It doesn't serve, cannot serve that purpose. And I had frequently updated, published my own summary of Holocaust and its critical assessment. It's called The Lectures on the Holocaust, which is volume 15 of the series. And it claims on the back cover that it is encyclopedic in scope, because that's what I'm trying to do, cover all the main topics. And but it's not organized alphabetically by buzzword. It's just a narrative. It was initially created out of actual lectures that I'd given in front of academic audiences back in the 90s. And it is written in a dialogue style, as the lectures were. My lectures that I was giving were not presenting people with what I thought are the facts, but I was presenting stuff in order to discuss it with the audience. So it's an interactive sessions with the audience that I had, because a controversial issue like this should be presented in a way that people can act, react, and interact. Because out of the world view down people's throats is not going to work. If you come with a quote-unquote outrageous news, outrageous view that is so off the mark of what people expect, you need to give them the opportunity to interact and to have control.
Germar, the idea of give and take and conversations building upon knowledge and a situation like you confronted, a subject that is so absolutely iron cast, it's their way or the highway. You know, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to do new analyses of information. They don't want new research presented and discussed and analyzed and decided upon in terms of worth and whether or not it fits into the truth. And it was an extraordinary thing you did. You stood up against the world, a large part of the world anyway, in bringing this material together in, I like the word accessible, very accessible format. It's reachable. It's not stilted academia. It's quite conversational.
But the real confrontational nature was in that book, Realized Lectures on the Holocaust. And of course, they didn't give in their assessment that book's name. They didn't give the series name, but they created something, Encyclopedia of the Holocaust, that didn't exist. I've seen that over and over again in our opponents' publications. If they talk about us, they misquote, misrepresent titles and names so that people don't find it. Oftentimes, some people get curious, oh, I want to look that up. What do they say? What's the name? You Google it and you find it instantly. It's a catastrophe for them. They don't want that to happen, so they put something on there that people will not get to the target. So that's what ticked me off. But it took me several months to figure out, wait a minute, it is true that I haven't published an encyclopedia on the Holocaust, but that's exactly what we should do. So I reserved the domain name that you just mentioned, where we have the encyclopedia now, holocaustencyclopedia.com. For some reason, it was available, so that was good. There are some mainstream Holocaust encyclopedias, but they are on normal site, like you go to the website of the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Their website has an encyclopedia as a subsection, and Yad Vashem has one too, but you have to go to their websites. It's not like holocaustencyclopedia.com. So I grabbed it. I was glad it was free, and then I defined the project, and we started a fundraiser on the website of the Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, which is a free speech platform lobbying for having an open and fair and civic debate on that topic, which is most censored in the Western world and where free speech is most embattled and threatened. And we raised funds for it, and I tried to get everyone who is able and willing to contribute on board with the project, which was not easy, to put it mildly. I could not find too many takers, and it wasn't looking too good. And back then, I was still the head of a five-headed family, three school-age kids, and I was the stay-at-home dad for the past 10 years. I have been a stay-at-home dad running a household, raising two, three kids. My wife had a career, and I was doing all these things on the, quote-unquote, on the side. It was clear I would be able to define a project like that, maybe direct it, manage it, supervise it, but there's no way I can be a major contributor to it in the personal situation. I was also, of course, running the publishing company, managing this massive series, and was also involved in this committee. So no way. Now, life threw me a curveball, and I ended up losing that family, going through a divorce right now. It's not easy, but that's a different issue. We don't want to go there. And I was then in crisis of my life that I had before. I needed work therapy. That's been working for me personally, psychologically speaking, emotionally speaking. Has always gotten me deeper into trouble because the work I pick is, okay, you want to destroy my career, you want to destroy my family, you want to destroy my life, I'm going to dig in and prove you that right. If you want to deny me that right, I dig even deeper. And that's what was a similar situation early last year. And I decided, wait a minute, the guy who says he needs an encyclopedia because he can't wrap his head around this 52-volume series has a point. I've already reserved the domain name. We have raised funds for it. I can't find anyone really to contribute with it. Why don't I sit down and do it? And that's what people do all the time. They sit down and write encyclopedias. You know, that's the normal thing in the world. As you know, you look up any encyclopedia on any topic, and it's always written by one author. That's just what happens, isn't it? No.
That's true. Yeah.
No. Any encyclopedia on any topic, usually, most certainly, Mark, I would say.
May I ask a question? When you were going through all these, there still are, the personal issues. And then when you go sit down and immerse yourself in the work, was that some kind of a, did it give you a respite? Did it give you a place of peace, an intellectual challenge to assemble all of your massive data and knowledge about this? Was that therapeutic for you to be able to work on the book, on the encyclopedia, in the face of having so many personal issues to have to deal with, which are no one would wish on anyone, but you did it somehow. I'm just wondering how you managed to do that.
As I mentioned, in past crises of my life, work therapy has worked for me to do something that makes sense. And we, in this, you know, I had a personal crisis of my marriage coming crashing down. This has nothing to do with revisionism. All my crises in my life before had to do with revisionism, when the governments were persecuting me, when they were trying to throw me into prison, when I had to go into exile and so forth. This is completely different. But in a way, you still need to have something that makes sense when 10 years raising children has been the emotional center and sense-giving center of your life. That suddenly disappears. It is a massive blow. And you need to hold on to something that makes sense, but also to something that distracts you. So under any circumstances, sensefulness has always been my anchor, has been my life raft, so to say. And the same here, taking on this massive project, you can't do that alone. You can't sit down and write an encyclopedia. Nobody does. That's just not happening. But yeah, try. I had another contributor, and we said, okay, we only two people. That's Thomas Dalton. You may have heard of him. His Debating of the Holocaust is a very good introduction into the topic, and it's volume 32 of our series. And has written other contributions more on the Jewish Zionist side of things, not so much the historical. But be that as it may, the two of us were the only ones who had signed up for the project. I went to my lectures, which has a subject index, and copied the subject index straight into an Excel sheet and said, these are the topics that need to be in the encyclopedia to begin with. That's an easy start because the lectures try to be encyclopedic in scope, so the subject index kind of should be an alphabetically sorted topic. It worked out well in terms of giving me a jump start by having two-thirds or so or half of the topics that we need to cover already right there defined. And then many more came and more afterwards, so it was growing. I said then to Thomas Dalton, okay, here's the list of the first 300 topics that we have. I pick some, and you pick some. So I went in and picked the first 100 topics, and he went in and picked his first 10 topics. I said, this is not going to go well. So I thought we both take half of it. So I didn't take 150 of the first 300 either, but 100, because it's just daunting task. There's a huge amount of topics that you have to, it's just, but I got going. I had 24/7, literally. I mean, I had problems sleeping because when you're emotionally completely distraught and your life is collapsing, I couldn't sleep.
Myself.
I was sleep deprived. But I used the time. Each time I woke up at 2 o'clock with a nightmare or whatever, I couldn't sleep. So I'm not tossing and turning, going up, and I'm working on it until I'm getting so tired that I crash out of the bed next to my desk, and then I just crash on the bed and have a nap whenever I need it. So I was in that rhythm. There was no day of the week from January, mid-January last year to mid-June. These 5 months uninterruptedly working on this, and in mid-June it was done. Thomas Dalton had contributed by then 8 contributions. He didn't even get around to the first 10 he had picked. He had written 8. One of them I had to give a major work over. That's then by the majority contribution that I added a lot to. So of the 579 entries we have, 572, more or less, were written by me, seven essentially by him.
Got it.
But once I got going, I had this friend who had actually said, we need this because I can't wrap my head around the series. We need this. And he was motivating me. He was inciting me. He was cheering me on. He was mesmerized and amazed by every contribution, every entry that I had the first draft, and he could see. And there was a positive feedback loop between him, who had become a mainstream and friend, giving me sense, purpose, direction, motivation, incentive, all the things that you need in this dark moment of your life when things have come crashing right down. And it gave me the impetus to keep going, keep going.
And Garmar, I remember your early work, which I would read back in the day, and it was extraordinary. With your academic scientific background, you were on your way to a PhD in chemistry. You don't play games. You're very, very serious. And so all the energy had a place to go, at least temporarily, while you worked through the personal crisis. This is a remarkable turn to see someone be able to do that. It doesn't happen very often.
Right. I mentioned to a friend, it is a historic singularity that I found myself in. My personal life, a historic singularity in terms of everything having crashed, and burned, my marriage, my family, everything was gone, my home, there was just nothing left. You are suddenly finding yourself in a deep black hole. You have really 24/7, and you need 24/7 distraction and occupation to not despair in this situation, and I found it there. So all the energy and all the time that I had completely focused, and whoever has seen me work, I have developed an extremely efficient way of working because I was doing all these things, you know, basically stay-at-home dad, raising three kids, running a household, getting dinner on the table. When mommy comes home, she expects dinner. It's a perfectly inverted traditional gender role. And at the site, running this publishing company, organizing the lobby group, the Code of Committee for Open Debate, and I had to be extremely efficient at what I do, and I have, over the years, developed all these efficient methods of doing things, and it all came together. Plus, I had 30 years of experience of publishing all the hard-hitting research that had come out on this topic.
Right.
And not only on the revisionist side, but the revisionists were focusing on what was coming from the other side. I published all the critical and scrutinizing studies that were taking on the opposing views that were published to refute us, to attack us over the years. I've done those, again, translated them, reissued them in addition. So all this is on my computer physically. It is in my head mentally, all this information, and not just once, as I said, sometimes. When you translate a book, you know a book better than the author because you have to go through every sentence, get the meaning just right. And I've realized that you sometimes realize much better and more intensive what is in the book when you have to translate it. And I translated it from Italian to English, from Italian to German, from English to German, from German, whatever the language was. Mm-hmm. And I was doing this in several languages and in new editions over and over again. So I had regurgitated this stuff and keep doing it. As I just mentioned, I'm going through Arthur Butt's book again. I have translated the whole thing anew from English into German because the original German edition was no good. That was back in 2010. And I've re-edited it over and over. So there was this historic singularity of having done 30 years and nothing else but researching, publishing, collecting, and wrapping my head around it, immersing myself in it over and over again, being always at the cutting edge front of what's going on. And I, without knowing, amassed this encyclopedic knowledge and material in my head and on my computer, and then I was here in a deep black hole, nothing left but to tackle this challenge, write an encyclopedia. Okay, you can't do that. You can. this is impossible. Nobody has ever done that single-handedly. You can't. Do it. And then I saw one entry after another. Yes, I can do it. And as a matter of fact, I realized if you have a knowledge, if they have the access to the information, if you really are so deeply immersed in a topic, it is actually better to have an encyclopedia written by just one person, because then it comes out as something that is internally consistent, cohesive, where every entry builds upon another, where entries link forth and back and refer to each other, and there is no conflict, there is no contradiction, there is no, sometimes pieces just not necessarily fit together because people have different views, states of knowledge.
Guillermo, it cannot be done. This work cannot be done by a committee. One guiding, inspiring individual has to weave it all together like a tapestry of total truth. And as you mentioned, you've got to relate this to that and that to this. If that isn't there, the depth of the project begins to, it doesn't happen. So you've got this done. Yeah. It's like a beautiful construction project. And with all the work you have done in prior decades, it's there. You did it.
Because I had to get the opposing encyclopedia, so I bought them on the internet, used copies. The biggest one, the Yad Vashem, four-volume, 1,900-page Holocaust encyclopedia of the Holocaust and a newer version of it.
Right.
Because I didn't have the self-confidence. I said, you can't write that. You don't even know what all has to go in there. I mean, I have the lectures. I have a list. I have other things that I can grab from here and there that needs to be added. But, you know, really hit all the important points and targets and issues and topics? Mm-hmm. I don't know. So I got those, and I analyzed those. And in order to write an encyclopedia, you have to first read what is already done, so I didn't only read
you have to.
Primary and secondary literature, but I got the real, quote-unquote, opposing encyclopedias, statistically analyzed them to know what's what? What are they doing? What is important? Do I miss something? Is there any entry that I need to add and write something about it? And then I knew after I had analyzed this encyclopedia, their encyclopedia, I said, it's easy to do better because, excuse my expression, but it's crap. Once I've realized what kind of a botched job Yad Vashem has done, they have not a single witness account addressed. The whole Holocaust narrative, the mainstream Holocaust narrative, rests on witness accounts. There's no forensic or documentary evidence of note that supports the essential parts of it, except for when it comes to mass shootings in the East. There are some mass graves. So that's the one thing where there's the truth part of it. But when it comes to extermination camps and other stuff, there's just no documentary or forensic evidence supporting it, because it's all built on eyewitness accounts. So you go through this 1,900, almost 900 entry strong encyclopedia from Yad Vashem, and you find nothing. There's not a single witness account explained, summarized.
That's almost a bogus effort. It's not done properly at all.
I couldn't believe it. There are 19 people in there who were witnesses, who did make statements, but they gave only biographic information about these people, not what they had testified. I couldn't believe it. So you can't do worse than that. So we have more than
300
witness accounts in our. We have almost more than 300 witnesses listed in our encyclopedia to show everyone this is what this is based on. We summarize them, we analyze them.
Right there.
I.e., whatever witness, yes. Mm-hmm. Perpetrators, mm-hmm. bystanders, and victims. All the central ones, they're all in there and explained. All of the references in the bibliography, we can find more. And it's all interlinked. So we can, and what I learned, a very important learning experience for me, having published all this material, amassed all this material, I was in the middle of a huge forest, a jungle of information myself.
Right.
I had some overview because I've climbed on this tree and that and looked over it, but I had not really a complete comprehensive overview. And for this encyclopedia, I had to get it. I inevitably did get the overview because I was just connecting it. I had to cross-reference here and there, and then I was seeing patterns in eyewitness accounts, what the opposing side calls the convergence of evidence. When so and so many people say that pigs can fly, then pigs just fly. And I could see it on so many occasions, patterns of witness statements going along the same line over and over again, even though you could prove, and that's also taught in all the entries that talk about forensic evidence that are in the encyclopedia, could say, no, that's not true. It can't be true, but they're all saying it. Why? So you see patterns, you start connecting dots, and see there is a big pattern of mass hysteria, of mass... societal cliche forming where everyone has an idea of what happened because everyone has been communicating. It has been communicated through all the mass medias. Before you know it, everyone has the same clue, quote-unquote, knowledge.
If they haven't been brainwashed and programmed, they have certainly been influenced by what they have been exposed to. And who owns the media?
Right after the war.
What message are they going to get over and over and over? So this we only have about 3 minutes, Guillermar, and I want to again mention, if you all would go to, if you have any interest in this, and I think most of you do, this is a reality check, this book. It is an extraordinary accomplishment by any academic measurement or historical measurement. HolocaustEncyclopedia.com. Look at the 29-minute video. It explains a lot of what Guillermar has been talking about. And if the book is something you want, you cannot do better than this book. If you want to go looking for reality and truth in history, it's here. And the amount of research, the amount of energy is extraordinary. Go ahead.
It's all on the website, too. So it's not that I'm trying to sell a book. It's nice to, if you guys think I want the book, the hardcover, the hard copy of it, it's for sale there. But basically, the whole information is there on the website, free to browse as every other Holocaust encyclopedia, interlinked with links to the bibliography, and in the bibliography, the links to the resources that are online. So it's all there. And it's... I have noticed that people who actually get the encyclopedia read it cover to cover. That's something that normal encyclopedias are not built to do, but this one is because it has so much amazing information every single entry. It's kind of mind-blowing to realize, oh, my God, this I didn't know, and this is so interesting.
Right.
Just normal people of all walks of life get this thing in the hand accidentally because, you know, I give it to them or whatever, and they start reading it. It's even though they are not history buffs, they get so mesmerized because everybody knows about the Holocaust, but then they realize, oh, I didn't know anything.
It's so interesting. They didn't know anything about it, really.
They can't put it down.
No.
And they can't put it down. It's every single entry is like opening a Christmas present. Wow, great. And the next one. And then it cross-references here and there, and they get lost and on a discovery journey that is just mind-blowing. And for me myself, sometimes I go back to the encyclopedia, start reading it, and say, oh, my God. By the end, I have written it. I had partly forgotten what I'd written in the early entries. I had to go back because it was supposed to do back reference. What did I write, where, when? And I look it up and said, oh, there's. Okay, I've already argued that point. I don't need to repeat it here. If that happens to me, it happens to the normal reader almost so.
I understand. If you go back and look at your own work and you're amazed. That's pretty neat. Here's what we want to remind you, HolocaustEncyclopedia.com. Go look at the video. And this is a tapestry of interconnected brilliance. It's one of the most remarkable achievements of my life that I've ever seen or come across. This book really opens the door to reality. And I hope you'll take a look at it, consider it, and if you like history like we do, I think this is an absolute must to consider. Guillermar, thank you for being here.
And anyone.
More than that, thank you for doing this fabulous, fabulous book. It's extraordinary, as I've said.
Yeah, I hope that people use it. It's there to inform. It's there to empower everyone to take charge of the topic, not to be bulldozed by opinion makers of the mainstream who try to push you in a corner. That empowers people. Free information for free people for a free future.
That's well said, and that's the whole thing. Okay, we'll talk again, Girmar. Thank you for your time. And again, what you've achieved here is a once-in-a-lifetime monumental accomplishment. Well done. Well done.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Okay, all right, you take care, and we'll talk again. All right.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Girmar Rudolph and the book The Holocaust Encyclopedia, Uncensored and Unconstrained, Freedom of Speech, but more than that, freedom to access reality and the truth. All right, we'll be right back in just a few. Hang on.